Okay, welcome to Exploration 1, Module 5, the second half that we are actually going to record. Unless we don't save anything of any consequence, and then it won't matter. Alright. So, we covered the fact that these routers had different numbers of ports, and we covered the fact that these routers... Yeah, we were splitting the subnet into four different subnets, and we were segregating the traffic, and I said that would be useful from a school's perspective. So, for example, you could drop everything that was destined to port 80, and then run all of the traffic through a filtering proxy server, for example, so that you actually get control of the traffic that students are visiting. And in fact, I know of a project that a friend was involved in that actually relied on allowing people to go to websites via inclusion. So you actually said, you can go to this website, but you can go three levels deep in this website from this URL. And it was actually an include system, not an exclude system, which is pretty scary. How many people here have played with OpenDNS? Which tends to be fairly cool.
Actually, when that came up on the list, I signed up for, I purchased the home version of it. What is it, $10 a year or something? It's pretty reasonable. Pretty cool once you get it working, because you can mistype URLs, and instead of getting ad pages, you get their nice little OpenDNS page. And plus, it also logs your traffic, should you want to monitor like your household web traffic or whatever.
Yeah, it's quite good.
Yeah, we tend to use it. One of the things I have noticed about OpenDNS, though, and this is something that you should be aware of, is when you look up something that doesn't exist, you will always get a false positive for one of their IP addresses, which is how it redirects the web browser to where it needs to go. So you never actually get domain does not exist. You get an IP address of something that's going to come back. At least I think that's the case. Let me just have a look here. NS lookup. Okay, www.scumcustard.com. Let's hope that doesn't exist. Oh, it doesn't, yeah. And you actually get a non-authoritative answer that points at 67.215.65.132. So be aware that you're not going to get the this domain does not exist error anymore if you're using OpenDNS, unless you turn off the redirect pages. You are always going to get a false positive on for one record of whatever you're looking up. Okay.
I haven't set up...
Sorry? Go ahead.
I was just saying, I haven't set up the account yet to take advantage of any of the filtering or whatever, but I did put the two servers' IPs into the router, and it's a noticeable change in speed for sure.
Absolutely. DNS requests do tend to go faster. And in fact, there's a little utility that... GRC guy. Mine's gone blank.
Steve Gibson.
Steve Gibson, that's him. I was thinking Steve and I couldn't come up with the last name. I had the st and my brain wouldn't go any further. It's probably a lack of chocolate eclair. And it's a thing called DNS Bench, and it will actually benchmark your DNS servers and tell you which ones are faster, and you can actually run a test on about 200 different DNS servers and find out which are the fastest ones and then plug them into your browser or plug them into your computer's configuration. So the good thing about OpenDNS is it does all sorts of things like, you know, content filtering. Well, not content filtering, but website filtering for various things that you don't want people going to and stuff like that. So the point I'm making, though, is these sorts of things you may want to set up at a school. You may want to set up different subnets to segregate traffic. You may actually want to set up proxy servers to control people's access to resources. And this is part of what subnetting is used for. The other thing to keep in mind is that if you're an internet service provider or you've got a large block of IP addresses, say, for example, you've been allocated a Class C of routable IP addresses, you may, and if you're running, doing the admin for a big company, say, for example, Humanware or Freedom, for example, they may have a whole stack of IP addresses that they might want to scatter over various offices and then hook the whole lot together into a virtual private network. And they may actually subnet up their routable block and route them around between the different offices inside their network so that you can have people working from home and still turning up on the local company network and stuff. So that's one of the other reasons for subnetting. So basically the entire point of subnetting is taking the addresses you've got and breaking them into the right sized blocks and setting the right subnet masks. And because we're using what we call VLSM, which is variable length subnet mask, which is the ones that don't have to land on the 8-bit boundaries, you can actually slice up the network into different size chunks. So say, for example, Alice suddenly gets Fred move in with her, you can split her network in half and have 32 addresses for Alice and 32 addresses for Fred. And then when Geraldine moves in with Bob, you can split his addresses in half and give 32 addresses to Geraldine and 32 addresses to Bob. So the point is you can subdivide these networks, but the smaller the divisions are, the bigger the overhead of two addresses is going to be on the subnet. So if you've got a subnet of 8 addresses and you can't use 2, you've only got 6 usable. But if you have a subnet of 16 addresses and you can't use 2, you've got 14 usable. Does that follow?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So some of the problems that you're going to be given are going to be things along the lines of you have this network and this network mask. You have these numbers of machines that are allocated for this particular thing. What subnets and subnet masks will you set up to allow this subnetting scheme given the addresses that you have been allocated? Now, we had an interesting situation a couple of years back. We had a council, there was an amalgamation of about 6 or 7 local councils into what we call the Clarence Valley Council, which was on the eastern coast of New South Wales, and they had all of their networks on a 10-dot subnet. So we had 10.20 and 10.18 and 10.10 and 10.0 and 10.12, and we wanted to set up dynamic routing, and they tried to set up dynamic routing with RIP version 1, which doesn't send a subnet mask with any of its updates. Can anybody tell me what the default subnet for a 10 network would be? And I'm not. Wouldn't be surprised if nobody remembers, but does anybody remember?
I could be totally off, but isn't it a Class A?
It certainly is. So we have a subnet mask of 255.0.0.0, which meant the entire 10 subnet was considered as one network for the routing protocol, and it didn't work at all. And this is one of the dangers to setting up a network on the 10 subnet, because you're too lazy to subnet, or it'll be just 10 and you can just start pulling numbers out of the air. It can be very difficult to actually manage your network, especially if you're using older or legacy routing protocols. And the other danger is, I don't know whether I mentioned, but there's actually a default subnet mask for various ranges of IP addresses. So if you go 1 to 127 is Class A, 128 to 191 is Class B, 192 to 223 is Class C. If you've got some very old and stupid devices that have hard-coded subnet masks in them, and these are very rare, but they do exist. You may have a situation whereas if you put a device on a 10-dot subnet, it may assume it has a Class A subnet regardless of what the actual network is set up to do, and that can cause you all sorts of problems as an administrator.
This does raise the question that why does Apple use that for their airport routers then?
Because they're home users and they don't need to know anything about how the computer works anyway, so why should they care? That's the answer to that. Well, you look at the, without getting into a philosophical debate, you look at the entire concept of Apple's technology. Unless you're a technician, you shouldn't need to know how it works. You should just turn on your iPod and sync it to your computer and soon sync it to iCloud, and you don't need to know what's going on under the hood. That's not your concern. So we'll just set it up for 10-dot, and I mean, let's face it, you're only using the airport at home anyway, so it's not as if it's a business setup. So why would you need a different subnetting strategy?
Fair.
Okay, any questions? Queries. I'm wondering if people want to have a look at that subnetting exercise with the offices and stuff, and we'll come back and talk about it next week, because it might make a bit more sense now that I've talked about how to slice things down and stuff. You don't have to get it right, but does everybody want to take a look at that one with Melbourne and Sydney and Adelaide and the adaptive tech office exercise that I put up, or the busy builders one? Either or.
Sounds good.
Yeah, I'm not expecting everybody to get it right. I'm just expecting people to take a look at it and see if they can see how it works. And the trick is to get the right number of bits for network, the right number of bits for host, and the right number of bits for subnetting so that you've got enough subnets to do what you want. And that's the trick. Oh, he's just moving around. Oh, actually, I've got something you can do while you're sitting around doing nothing. Well, not nothing, but I'll just get them for you. Why is it that when I want something out of my bag, it disappears? It's alright, I'll bring them over to you. So, has anybody got any queries, questions on any of that before we move on to the notes proper?
I don't think so.
Anyone confused? Here you go. It's a wireless keyboard. Yeah, sorry, go ahead, John.
I just had one comment, if this would be helpful to anybody else. I did find it helpful with doing the subnetting was to work out the binary values from with basically all the from with the 8 bits at least. So you'd have 1 and all the rest zeros, 1 and all the rest zeros, work all those out in decimal and make a kind of a chart of them just to make it a bit easier for myself to map out the binary to decimal values of those particular particular numbers out when working through these.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Anybody else done that? So you've got a chart that basically tells you that, you know, you've got .0, you've got .254.248.240.224.192.128.64, all that sort of stuff. So you have the different subnet masks written out.
No, I don't, but that's a good idea.
Yeah, so convert 1000000 to decimal and you'll get 64. Convert the 11000 to decimal and you'll get .96. All that sort of stuff. and that way you've got an idea of what the last 8 bits of the subnet mask, unless you're doing things bigger than 8, which you can work out on an as-needs basis, but that way you'll have some idea as to what number they're going to show up at. Okay, the module 3... the module 4 stuff. Okay. The OSI transport layer, which isn't very exciting, but is very important. It is responsible for the end-to-end transport of data, and it is responsible for data integrity. So, protocols that operate at the transport layer, we're looking at things like TCP is a transport layer protocol. The transport layer enables multiple applications to communicate over the network at the same time using a single device. Can anybody tell me what mechanism allows multiple applications to talk over the one network? Differentiate between configurations. Sorry? No, not multiplexing. Well, kind of multiplexing, but...
Ports.
Yes, it's the port numbers, or the socket numbers. Destination, source IP, source port, destination IP, destination port. And that is how you can have multiple conversations over the same network channel. Make sure all of the data is received in order and correctly by particular applications. Employs error handling mechanisms. So, in other words, you check all your packets, and if you're missing a packet, you ask for a retransmit in the case of TCP. If you get a packet that's corrupt, you ask for a retransmit. If you're getting too many packets, you just drop the ones you can't deal with. And you also, with TCP, they have what we call an exponential back-off algorithm, which means that if something isn't received in a certain amount of time, and I'll just keep this simple, let's say you don't receive something for a second, you send a retransmit request. If you don't receive something in that 1 second, you wait 2 seconds and send a retransmit request. If you don't get something in 2 seconds, you wait 4 seconds and send a retransmit. If you don't get something then, you wait 8 seconds and send a retransmit request. Does anybody have any ideas why they might use an exponential back-off algorithm?
In case there's network latency or trouble with transmission.
They basically use an exponential back-off algorithm to prevent the retransmit requests from saturating the network. Because if you're sort of going retransmit, 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 that can actually contribute to the network congestion as much as the errors and stuff that are happening. Go ahead.
I just said, oh, okay.
It also segments data, so the segmentation of data happens at the transport layer, and it figures out which application gets which data based on the port numbers and stuff. And, of course, it adds headers, so there are transport layer headers that are responsible for packet sequencing and the ability to reassemble out-of-order streams. Applications don't really need to know anything about the specifics of the network at the transport layer. They just shuffle data down and the transport layer segments it up and sends it over the network. The reason things are segmented up, and you sort of might ask yourself, why would we even segment data up? It's to prevent applications from monopolizing the network. So basically what you've got is, because we're dealing with a packet switched network, you have what we call time division multiplexing. So only one packet can be in flight at a particular time, and you basically allocate, depending on how many packets you allocate to a particular application, depends on how much time it gets to transmit and how much data it is able to transmit. has anybody tried to do any real work on a network while somebody is torrenting flat out? And if so, how fast does it go?
Pretty much useless.
Yep. Torrents can saturate a network. And the other reason why, well, part, one of the reasons ISPs hate torrents, apart from getting all the letters about people pirating, you know, episodes of Ally McBeal, is because you are now utilizing all of your upstream bandwidth that they didn't think you were going to use. They were hoping you were only watching YouTube and going on Facebook, but you're hammering the upstream just as much as you can to get that episode of Ally McBeal. And we don't talk about quality of service and bandwidth control in the official lectures for this course, so we may cover those as an extension module, but suffice it to say, how this time is divided up between the applications makes a big difference on how fast the network behaves and how responsive it is. Has anybody ever seen the situation where somebody's doing a really big download and nobody else gets any bandwidth?
Absolutely.
Anyone else seen this?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, so somebody's getting like 300k a second and you're getting like 4. And it's not fair. So obviously this is a real problem for people. And it's important to be able to manage these resources and handle this in a fair way. Okay, any questions before I continue? Oh, I'll take that as a no. Alright. TCP, Transmission Control Protocol. There are two types of packets that can be... Well, two types of broad protocols in the TCP/IP suite. We have TCP, which is reliable end-to-end communication, and we have UDP, which is the user datagram protocol, which is a fire and forget protocol. You just blot out the datagram, and unless the upper level application checks, you have no way to know whether that datagram got to the other end or not. And we will talk about UDP a bit more later. We are using a combination of TCP and UDP for our conversation. TCP is used to keep everything synchronized, and UDP is usually used for the voice traffic, I believe. Although Ventrilo is kind of a closed protocol, so we're not totally sure about that. So, connection-oriented conversation. You open a circuit, you open a source port, source socket, destination port, destination socket, and you are able to talk over that socket in both directions simultaneously. Reliable delivery. In other words, you can be assured that your data gets from one end of the link to the other, or not at all. Ordered data reconstruction. There is nothing in IP that says that packets have to be sent in the order that you give them to the router. Okay? So, say for example, Corey's torrenting the latest episode of Big Brother. I have no idea why he would do this, but he might be. And his friend is uploading a very important project to the company website. It is possible for him to prioritize his friend's upload above his torrent of whatever it was, Big Brother. We're not actually saying that he is torrenting Big Brother, this is just for example only. And he would then be able to prioritise that traffic in such a way, which would mean that the packets that his friend was sending to the company server to upload the very important project can be sent not only before the torrent packets, but they can also be sent out of order and they will be reconstructed at the other end. Flow control. So in other words, if data is travelling too fast on a link, or you're overloading a router along the path, TCP has mechanisms to limit the speed at which traffic is being sent and to slow things down. Okay, so TCP is end-to-end reliable, handles end-to-end error detection, And UDP is fire and forget. We just send the datagram out, and we it's up to the protocols above that if they decide to even check that over. Low overhead, no acknowledgement for UDP. Pieces of data in UDP are called datagrams. In other words, user datagram protocol. That's what it stands for. So the TCP header is 20 bytes, and the UDP header is 8 bytes. Can anybody see that the UDP has far less overhead than TCP if TCP header is 20 and the UDP header is 8? Okay, my notes say discuss source and destination ports. I don't think I really need to do that. I did that a couple of weeks ago, but essentially you bind a source port and a source IP. You then send traffic to a destination IP and a destination socket, and this is how your computer differentiates between the various connections that it has, and it's how your network address translator keeps track of which connections are open and which machines they came from. Ports 0 to 1023 are well-known server-based ports. You normally need administrative privileges to bind a port under 1023. Under Unix, that means you need to be the super user or a group with super user power. Under Windows, you probably need to be administrator to bind a port under 1024. You've then got registered ports from 1024 to 49,151, and then from 49,152 all the way up to 65,536, you have dynamic ports that are used by applications and that are not allocated to anything in particular. Does everybody know how NetStat works? Has anybody looked at NetStat?
Shows you what connections are currently open and whether they're established or suspended.
I've used it on Linux. Yep. I haven't done it on Windows.
Alright, one of the useful ones to do is to do a netstat-B bar more, I think. I'll just check this. Netstat-B. And it will sit there for a while. Yeah, that's it. It actually shows you the process name that actually has the connections open, so...
What does it mean when it says closed wait? Does that mean it's just not being used, but it's waiting for data on that?
No, it means... Okay, we'll get to that eventually. It means that TCP has asked the connection to close... and it's sent the FIN packet, but it's waiting for the acknowledgement packet to the FIN packet, so it's basically stuck in a half-closed state.
Oh.
Well, you did ask, so and I said we would get to it later, but that's what it means. In other words, the connections are half-closed. Okay, so everybody, if you haven't run NetStat, have a go at it at some point. Okay, so the way TCP keeps track of its packets is it uses what we call sequence numbers and acknowledgement numbers. And a sequence number is basically a counter from 1 to whatever. And basically what happens is that they increment as the packets go over the network. And the point of the sequence numbers is so that it can actually reorder packets. So it must create a session between two hosts for the communication to function. We will cover the sequence numbers more in a second. The sequence number is usually set at the last byte the host is sent, okay? So when you open a TCP connection to another host, you end up with a situation where you don't normally start the sequence numbers off at 1, because if you do, you'd be able to guess what is actually going on. And you'd be able to guess sequence numbers and inject packets, and that could be quite bad. So what you do is you start the sequence numbers that say, 14,000, or something, random number. So when you open a TCP connection, there's actually a three-way handshake. The first packet that is sent is called a synchronization packet, and it's called a SYN packet. You then receive, and let's say that's got a sequence number of 14,000, you then receive an acknowledgement packet, which has no payload in it, which then is set to 14,001, and then you send another synchronization packet back, which will be set to 14,002, and that is how you make sure that the sequence numbers at both ends of the connection are in sequence, because there are sequence numbers that run both ways, one in the send direction and one in the receive direction, and you've got to keep both of those synchronized. Anybody got any questions on that?
So that's part of the checksum part of it?
No, absolutely not. It is part of the packet ordering protocol. These sequence numbers are to keep the stream in order and to allow it that if packet 3 comes before packet 2, the sequence numbers will allow it to reorder the packets in the buffers once packet 2 turns up so that the application sees packet 1, 2, 3 instead of 1, 3, 2.
Okay.
Yes.
Would the sequence numbers in one direction, could they increase faster than another, or is it generally for each packet, are they generally, you know, you send the same amount of packets in each direction?
No, they certainly can go faster in one direction than the other. What are you guys up to over there? Like hook it into a monitor and stuff?
Hook it into a monitor and trip from it.
Okay, does it have a VGA port on it, does it? Okay. Okay. Yeah, basically the sequence numbers increment depending on how much data you're sending in each direction. So it's quite possible for a sequence number to go 1, 2, 3, 1400, 1600, 1800, 1903 in one direction, and 1, 2, 3, 20, 30, 60, 80 in the other direction. There is absolutely nothing that says that the sequence numbers need to be synchronized in both directions.
Question?
Sorry?
What happens when the numbers, if the numbers overflow?
I believe the sequence numbers wrap. So, I'm not sure how many bits are for this.
Is it like an unsigned number, so they wrap back to zero, or?
Yes.
And I wonder if that's, is it actually defined in the spec, or is it sort of implementation dependent?
There are problems with file sizes over 2 gig, but that's a different problem. As far as I know, it is defined in the spec. I'd have to actually look at the particular RFC, but when the sequence number overflows, because it's only a sequence number, it does then wrap background to zero and start incrementing. There are sort of nasty games you can play with sequence numbers, but I think. Yeah. The point is, the sequence numbers are incremented depending on how many bytes are in the packet. So if you are, well, they have to be at least incremented by one. But if you have a payload, you then increment the number of bytes by the payload that you've got plus one. So it will always be the next byte that the host is going to receive. Okay, so when, say for example, you send 100 bytes, you increment the sequence number by 100, the next acknowledgement that comes back should come back with a sequence number of 101. But luckily, they don't have any nasty questions on the test that ask you things like that. That is just how it works. Now, the other thing you have in TCP is what we call a receive window. Now, if you're sending packets over a link and you're saying, I sent you a packet, did you get it? Yep. I sent you a packet, did you get it? Yep. I sent you a packet. Did you get it? Yep. That is obviously very slow. And if you've got a round trip on a link of, say, half a second to a second, you are going to seriously restrict data throughput because you're waiting for an acknowledgement for every packet. So what TCP does is it uses what we call a sliding window. So it says, all right, I'm going to set up a window of 4 packets. And what you can do is you can go packet 1, packet 2. And then the other end goes, got packet 1. Packet 3, packet 4. Got packet 2, got packet 3. Packet 5, packet 6. I didn't get packet 4. Packet 4. I got packet 5, I got packet 6. So what actually happens with the window is that you can have a number of packets out on the wire without them being acknowledged, and you can actually wait for the acknowledgements to come back. Any questions, queries, clarifications?
If there's, say, 5 packets and it hasn't received packet 4, how does it know? Is it just looking at the sequence numbers to determine which packets it hasn't received?
That's exactly right. It is looking at the sequence numbers to make sure it's got all of the necessary packets. And as far as I know, there are two ways of doing it. One is where you have to receive all of the packets, otherwise it asks for retransmit. So if it goes packet 1, 2, 3, it misses packet 4, and then it goes 5, 6, then the stack will go, no, I want packet 4, and now I want packet 5, and now I want packet 6. That's the old way of doing windowing. But then in newer TCP stacks, including Windows and Linux and stuff, we've got what's called selective acknowledgement. And selective acknowledgement is where it can acknowledge various packets and ask for particular packets to retransmit. And obviously that is nicer on bandwidth than having to re-synchronize the transmitter and receiver and retransmitting the packets that it missed. It can selectively acknowledge the ones that it didn't get.
But I'm thinking that if it's just going by sequence number, then it knows if it has missed something because suddenly the sequence number of a packet that it's received will be higher than what it expects, but it doesn't know, you know, did it miss one packet or did it miss 2 packets?
No, that's right. But the fact is that it has to wait, or it has to organize. It has to have enough buffer space to have a whole window full of packets. And until it has a complete window full of packets, it can't hand those up to the application. So it has to make sure that it gets the entire window full of packets with the correct sequence numbers, whether it's using selective acknowledgement or not, before it can actually hand that data up to the application.
But if it knows that it should be expecting a packet with a sequence number of 11, and it gets, you know, packets with sequence numbers of, you know, 15 and 20 and 25, I don't think it knows whether it's missing a packet, one packet with 5 bytes, or a packet with 2 bytes and a packet with 3 bytes. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I do. And I'm not 100% sure of how that situation is handled. That's something I would also have to look up.
Okay.
No, no, no. It's a valid question, but I'm just not sure how it would actually do that. I know that it has... Each packet has a length. So it knows how long the packets have to be. Like, there is actually a length field in the packet, and that allows it to calculate the next sequence number that it should see. So I think it can work out... I think it actually says, I'm expecting this packet with this particular sequence number. And it can work that out based on the sequence numbers that it's already received, and then based on what comes in, it then figures out what the next sequence numbers are. But don't hold me to that, but I'm pretty sure that's how it works.
Okay, I think that still leaves a gap that it's not sure about, but we can figure it out later on.
Yeah, I'm sure there's an article in Wikipedia on TCP that will probably explain it to us quite nicely, and we can probably work out how it actually happens. Did I tell you guys? You guys are all eligible for the free copy of the TCP/IP Networking Guide, which is an e-book. It's an older edition, but it's still a useful ebook. And you need to send me an email to exploration-instructors at ciscovision.org, telling me that that you would like a copy of the TCP/IP book, and that you will not hand it on to other people. And if you want that book, it's not required for the completion of this course, but you don't have to pay for it. It's got lots of cool information on TCP in it. And I think I may have already sent it to you, Chris. I'm not sure. Did I send you that big book on TCP? I thought I did.
I'm not sure. But it probably answers all the questions I've been asking for the last 10 minutes.
Well, that's kind of why I thought of it. But that's not... Yeah, you know, I'm not saying that I won't go and look it up as well, but it may answer the questions, and that might be good. It's a big PDF, so you can all have a cry about the fact that it's a big PDF and then do something about it. I'm sorry, but that's what we got given. It's better than it being in something like, you know, ClarisWorks or, you know, Ventura Publisher. So we'll go with the PDF.
ClarisWorks. Wow. I haven't heard that in a while.
Well, it was one of the more obscure formats I could think of, or perhaps WordStar.
Beat me to it, WordStar.
Yeah. Oh, okay. If a segment is not if a segment is not acknowledged, the segments are retransmitted with an exponential backoff timer. So,
okay.
You don't say you didn't get something. You have to say you got it. Otherwise, it keeps getting sent at you. So my understanding is you just wait around long enough, and it will eventually turn up. Okay, now the point of selective
protocol
ACK...
Protocol designers are smart.
Yeah. Well, there were some pretty smart cookies working on this. With selective acknowledgement, you can actually say, I got packets 1 through 4, 6 and 7. And then it can say, oh, I've got to resend packet 5. So that's how selective acknowledgement works. Window size can grow and shrink depending on network conditions. So depending on how error-prone your network is, depends on whether it's, you know, going to get lots of retransmits or whatever, but you can actually change the window in the middle of a TCP connection. And that's transport layer. Any questions, queries? That got heavier than I thought it would, but there you have it.
This was recorded, right? Because I think I'm going to need to go back on this one. But, I think I'm good for now.
Yeah, it says recording in progress for this bit. I was very annoyed at myself for not recording the first half. But it does happen once in a blue moon. So, what do you do?
Yeah, this one's a bit more involved, but... get there, just give it a re-listen and reread through the chapter as well, now that I've heard you explain.
Okay, yep. Alright, I'll keep recording. Lab question from John.
One of the labs talks about doing multiple telnet connections to like qcat.org and to the remote bundle, and I just wonder if you could go over that exactly. Should we be remoting into the same pod, or does it have to be one connection to each pod, so the switch will let you remote in, or exactly how is that done?
Hang on a sec.
Hey, Greg already has. Yeah. Otherwise, he couldn't use it.
I don't know. We didn't bring them down.
out.
He doesn't have one, you can come back and get one, but...
Yeah.
Give him three.
Sorry. You're asking about how to get multiple Telnet connections into the remote bundle. Sorry, we just had somebody walking in wanting to borrow monitors. And you were asking how... Let me think. How to get multiple connections into the serial switch? That was the question?
Yeah, one of the labs talks about doing multiple connections, I guess, so you can... multiple connections at one time. And I just wondered if you
so
had
just
to
press,
do...
Press Alt-N on TerraTerm, and it gives you another one. Bang! Like that. Alt-N. Another
and
connection.
Then, okay. And to use... to actually log into it, then, do you have to log into... You know, a different pod on each time, or will the switch let you do, say, pod one for each connection and do three of them?
Yeah, you can go into pod one three times, but you can only go into each device once. So you can go into workstation one once, you can go into workstation two once, you can go into router one once, you can go into switch one once. Because once you have hold of a serial port, only one user can use it at a time. So when you connect in, it will allocate it to one of the telnet sessions, and then that's that. You can actually execute commands from the serial switch to disconnect one, but that is essentially how that works. But Alt-N will give you a new window, and I think it's Control-Tab to switch between windows. Does anybody remember?
Yeah, I believe that's right.
And the title bar changes, which helps. That's a good point. If you haven't looked at subnettinghints.txt under extras in the lab folder, go look at it. So subnettinghints.txt is, I reckon, kind of cool. And I said that so that it would make the recording. Okay, any other things outstanding before I hit the stop button?